BMW X5 SUV. All were parked out to the side of the small office that adjoined the hangar, not far from where she waited with her own car. The drivers had parked the vehicles, apparently leaving the keys inside, and then had all gotten into another black SUV and driven away, without saying anything to anyone as far as Victoria had been able to see. Curiouser and curiouser. Coffee had been offered when she'd arrived, and it was gratefully accepted. The temperature at this altitude had already been dropping, promising a bracingly chilly October evening, especially to someone who had come from the far warmer city of New Orleans. She had also been invited to wait inside the small office section, where there was a warm, comfortable, if small, lounge area with newspapers, magazines, and a flat screen offering, a woman named Karen had told her pleasantly, satellite channels, and a recliner comfortable enough for a nap. Instead, refusing the offer with polite thanks, Victoria had wandered around on foot for a while, drinking her coffee and stretching her legs after the long trip north. Not thinking about why she was here, but distracting her mind with far more trivial things. About the airstrip. The people who had delivered vehicles so silently and efficiently. And those who clearly worked here in other capacities in what appeared to be a 24/7 year-round operation. All were pleasant, smiling, and not disposed to talk overmuch. Were they feds? She didn't know. Maybe only technical support? Private security? She hadn't seen a sign of anyone being armed, and nobody had objected to her wandering, either before or after darkness had fallen. She found that interesting. Victoria had entered the office area only once more, for a second cardboard cup of coffee that she carried back outside. That, plus the jacket she'd gotten from her car, left her warm enough to remain outside, and allowed her to witness the arrival of at least part of the group gathering here, probably for no more than a few minutes before they'd be choppered up to the mountain house. The jet taxied to within about 20 yards from the hangar, closer to her at this end of the structure, and its roar quieted and then dropped off even more to a low rumble as men carrying blocks hurried to place them in front of and behind the wheels. Victoria watched as the jet's door opened, the stairs that were part of the door let down with it. She wasn't very surprised when Bishop was first off the plane, heading immediately toward her. His lithe, almost feline grace and deceptively easy stride marked him as an athletic man, very comfortable in his own skin, and Victoria thought every time she saw him that he was physically more powerful than he looked, and that he wielded a great deal more of other kinds of power than even the massive government organization to which he belonged could boast. He could, she believed, be a very dangerous man. He was most certainly the first man she would turn to in times of trouble, any kind of trouble. Beating him to the punch, she said as he reached her, "I knew you'd get us eventually. I made a bet with Sully. He owes me $100.
"He didn't think I'd get you?"
"Not in less than 5 years. I guessed within 3, so I win."
Bishop smiled faintly. "How have you been, Victoria?"
"Fine," she said mildly. "Until this morning. Still wondering if you had anything to do with that, by the way."
"Not one of my abilities," he said, equally mild. "If I could summon psychics from thousands of miles away, I think I would have known about it before now."
"Then who or what did?"
"That is the question, isn't it? One of them, at least. Are you ready to go up to the house?"
"Yeah. Bags in the back seat. Do I lock up the car?"
"Not unless you want to. Excuse me for a minute."
He headed toward the office end of the building, apparently to make or finalize arrangements, and Victoria remained where she was, watching others disembark from the jet, only two carrying bags like her duffel. She knew them, to varying degrees. except the one bringing up the rear, carrying 3 bags in his large hands. He was very large all over, an obviously powerful man who looked like he worked out hard for a living and then tossed around granite boulders for fun. Big granite boulders. Miranda reached her first. She was carrying a single bag. Hey, Victoria.
Miranda, who's the big guy?
I forgot you hadn't met Galen. He's SCU. Victoria glanced past her to look at the big man again.
He doesn't look much like a healer, she said.
She had always been interested in names and their meanings and origins.
You'd be surprised, Miranda murmured. If we're leaving as quickly as I believe we are, I'll introduce you up at the house.
Yeah, I thought Bishop wasn't wasting any time, at least not getting us to base. Then she looked past Miranda again, this time at the other woman she definitely recognized.
Hey, Olivia.
Hey, Tori.
The only person Victoria allowed to get away with the diminutive of her name. Olivia was, at 28, 2 years older than Victoria, but at 5'0" and petite, with copper hair that framed her heart-shaped face in a simple shoulder-length cut, large blue eyes holding a faintly startled expression, plus a childlike voice. Olivia had always seemed the younger of the two. An indignant feline howl from the carrier she held in one hand drew Victoria's attention, and her smile widened. I can tell Rex still hates to travel.
He made a horrible fuss on the jet until Bishop talked to him,
Olivia confessed.
Then he settled down for the rest of the flight, I think. But he wants out, and I think he saw the choppers. He hates them even worse than the planes.
She brushed a strand of copper hair away from her face with a small, fragile hand, an unconscious sigh escaping her.
Still the headaches?
Victoria asked with genuine sympathy, noting that the other woman's pretty face was unusually pale even for her, and that the big eyes were darkened.
Yeah, and since this morning worse than usual. Miranda gave me a couple of pills when the jet picked me up in Vermont, and they knocked me out for most of the flight, so I got some rest. But the pain was back when I woke up.
There was nothing of complaint in her childlike voice, merely a matter-of-fact acceptance of something she lived with virtually every day of her life. Victoria looked at Miranda.
Are we getting an actual healer to go along with us on this jaunt? I'm thinking we'll need one, and not just to help Olivia and Sully with their headaches.
We're getting the best in the unit, but Hollis and Reese won't get here until sometime tomorrow.
Hollis Templeton?
Miranda nodded. Victoria let out a low whistle.
Heard of her. A lot. And some pretty wild stuff even for us. According to the psychic grapevine, there isn't much she can't do.
There are always limits, but it's fair to say Hollis is still exploring hers, so we aren't yet sure of which ability she'll end up with, or how strong they'll ultimately become. In the meantime, we're certainly hoping she can help with Olivia's and Sully's headaches, and any other painful problems that might come along.
Olivia set Rex's carrier down on the ground, ignoring the profane feline muttering from inside it, and said,
How come everybody else hears stuff on the psychic grapevine? And how do you, Tori? Telepathy's still not your thing, right?
Right. No more than it's yours.
Victoria smiled.
But this grapevine is the real sort, with people, psychics, talking out loud and otherwise communicating via traditional channels, usually on the phone. And there's email, at least for those of us who don't short out electronics. Reno keeps in touch.
Olivia nodded.
Oh, that grapevine. She keeps in touch with me, too. But I don't remember her mentioning anybody named Hollis.
Victoria wasn't surprised. Olivia was very nearly as fragile as she looked, in more ways than one, and no doubt Reno's checking in with her had been more about making sure Olivia was all right than it was about passing on information. Victoria had always believed that Reno was a born caretaker,
though she didn't look it and seldom sounded it. It was also interesting that her first name, more commonly given to a Latin American male child, meant to rise again, like a phoenix. Except that a phoenix rose from the ashes of its own destruction, and as far as Victoria knew, Reno had never come close to being destroyed. Yet, at least. She hunched her shoulders against the chill she told herself was only the October night. Miranda was saying easily, "Things tend to happen quickly with Hollis, especially during investigations, so it's sometimes hard to keep score. But you'll be meeting her and Reese tomorrow." Victoria nodded, then said curiously, "I was wondering about Dalton. Did he call in?" "No." "But he was summoned?" Miranda nodded, smiling faintly. Victoria looked at her for a moment and then laughed. "Don't tell me. You sent Reno to fetch him." "Do you know anybody else who could take Dalton somewhere he doesn't want to be?" "No," Victoria said, and laughed again. "Not even Bishop." Tuesday evening, October 7. Leslie Gardner slipped from the bed, not trying to be particularly quiet since Ed was snoring and always slept like the dead anyway. His was a curiously gentle, rhythmic snore, and she had teased him their entire married life about it. Her own personal sound machine, lulling her to sleep. At least, it always had. They'd been in bed by a bit after 11, as usual after a busy weekday, and as usual he fell asleep right away. But not Leslie. Not even her own personal sound machine helped much lately. Her head was pounding so hard she had to feel her way to the bathroom, and when she got there and eased the door closed, she turned on only the light in the shower, dim behind its curtain. Even that hurt her eyes. She didn't know what time it was except that it was late, and she had to be up early to fix the kids' lunches and make breakfast. She needed her sleep. The supposed painkillers she had taken hardly 2 hours before had not even taken the edge off the pain. She wanted to take more, but the bottle was empty. Her head had been hurting on and off for days. Note to self, buy something stronger tomorrow. There was a small padded bench between the shower and the vanity, and Leslie sat there for what seemed like a long time, her elbows on her knees, and both hands pressed to the sides of her head. It hurt. It hurt, and somewhere inside that throbbing pain, inside her aching brain, she could have sworn she heard, very faintly, two words whispered. That was all. Just two words. But everything in her shied away from listening to those words, even acknowledging what they were, even though the silent battle made her head hurt more. Trying not to moan with the pain, but also trying to hold back those awful words, to pretend she didn't hear them, that everything was normal. It was just a headache. She talked to herself aloud, her voice soft. "I have to sleep. I have to get back into bed with Ed and sleep. Tomorrow things will be better. Tomorrow things will be fine. My head won't hurt anymore. The light won't bother me anymore. I won't hear impossible words. And I won't see anything strange. Everything will be back to normal, I'm sure." She used the vanity to help lever herself upright and clung to it for long minutes because she felt dizzy and weak. She splashed cold water on her face and dried it with a towel, resisting until that moment any glance into the mirror above the sink. In the dim light, she saw her face, pale but her own, eyes huge and oddly blurry. Maybe because of the words in her head, the words she refused to hear. Maybe that. Or maybe it was something else. She stared at herself for a long minute, then looked past her left shoulder. It was her shadow on the light-colored wall. Just that, just her shadow, except that it had a funny red tint. That was one thing that was wrong. The other thing that was wrong was that she shouldn't have had a shadow just there, with the dim light in the shower. It was on the wrong side. And besides, she shouldn't have had a shadow at all. Not like that. Not all distorted. Not a monster shadow. Feeling a little sick and a lot shaken, Leslie Gardner slipped back into bed beside her snoring husband, very carefully not looking to see if the shadow had followed her even here into the dark. Wednesday, October 8. In the bedroom of a small but surprisingly cozy cottage on an all-but-deserted island in the Bahamas, Rhys DeMarco woke to find himself alone. He woke early, out of long habit, but not this early, not without reason. The reason this time was the empty place beside him. It was still dark outside, and the muffled sounds of the ocean told him it was approaching high tide only a dozen or so yards from the cottage. There was no light in the bedroom, but when he looked at the nearly closed door, he could see a light coming from the living space beyond. He got out of bed and found a pair of sweatpants to pull on, then went out to the living room to find what he expected to find. The scent of coffee was sharp in the morning air, a glance toward the compact kitchenette showing him the coffee maker with a pot already half empty. Hollis was on the couch, the big coffee table before her covered with papers and her open laptop, which was plugged into a wall outlet. A mostly empty coffee cup sat on the end table beside the couch. She was barefoot and bare-legged, and wearing nothing but a man's white shirt that made her look, even with her recent golden tan and the few pounds he'd managed with his cooking to add to her slender frame, deceptively fragile.
"Can't sleep?"
he asked, leaning on the back of the couch slightly to one side of her.
"I slept, as long as I could."
"Sorry if I woke you." She leaned back and looked up at him with a faint smile, and returned his deep and not at all brief kiss with matching fire. It was one of the things they had discovered for themselves during the weeks away from the job and other people. A passion for each other of rather astonishing ferocity, something that was still a new aspect of their partnership, but one very much treasured even more for the long and difficult path that had brought them here, separately and together. And something that had most certainly deepened their already strong connection to each other. That last fact had also created a few surprises for them as yet untested in the field.
"Don't start something," she murmured when she could. "Why not? We have a few hours of vacation left."
"Yeah, but right now, something about this summoning business is bugging me. And you know how I get when something's bugging me."
He knew.
Looking at the coffee table, he noted a ruler and a red marker, as well as a couple of pencils and pens and a legal pad, supplies she generally carried in her laptop case, and realized for the first time what most of the papers spread out on the table were.
"We're on an island that's barely inhabited, and you found a map of the southeastern U.S.?"
Turning her attention back to the map, Hollis said absently, "It's amazing what you can find if you need it."
"Are you conjuring things out of thin air now?"
She frowned at him.
"Just asking."
"No, I haven't sprouted a new ability," she said dryly. "At least not one that you don't know about. I just noticed something on the flight over here that my pilot obviously missed."
"I had other things on my mind," he said apologetically. "What did I miss?"
"A whole bunch of rolled-up maps behind our seats in the chopper. So I went and looked, and found these." He eyed her.
"You went out there in the middle of the night wearing nothing but my shirt?"
The helicopter sat waiting for them in a clearing some little distance from their cottage. "Barely inhabited island," she reminded him.
"Uh-huh. But inhabited? You realize that our landlady's teenage son is fascinated by you?"
A fact he had noted during the occasions when they'd been out on the beach or zipping around on jet skis or scuba diving in the incredibly clear water. When Hollis's brief swimsuit had shown off much more of her than her normal casual clothing. Difficult to miss a teenage boy wearing a puppy dog look of extreme yearning and devotion, even at a distance, as he lurked, apparently believing himself hidden. Even more difficult for a powerful telepath to miss the tangled adolescent thoughts practically catapulted their way. There were only three major structures on their small island. Their cottage, a currently empty cottage a couple hundred yards away from theirs, and a much larger building at the other end of the island that served as an inn during the winter months, which were all owned by their widowed landlady, who lived there with her 16-year-old son and a small staff of employees who kept the inn and cottages in good order. Hollis said, "He's fascinated by the chopper. I caught a glimpse of him lurking in the bushes while I was digging around for the maps."
"In the middle of the night?"
"It's nearly dawn. Sun'll be up soon. I guess he gets up early." DeMarco sighed. She grinned at him.
"You are a sadistic woman," he told her.
"It'll keep you on your toes," she said, not at all apologetically. Then added, "Come look at this, will you?" He came around the couch to sit beside her, looking obediently at the big map. The legal pad had been pushed to the side, its top sheet, at least, covered with Hollis's neat flowing script in what appeared to be a list, but he leaned forward, elbows on his knees, and focused his attention on the map. There were numerous small red circles grouped in a rather small area of the southeast, most in the southern Appalachians, and most of the markings clearly indicated towns. DeMarco studied them for a moment, then straightened to look at his partner.
"The locations of past cases?"
"Yeah. It occurred to me that a disproportionate number of cases these last years have taken place in the southeast, mostly in little mountain towns, but some as far south as Atlanta, and as far east as the coast." He glanced at her laptop, which was clearly in sleep mode, pushed aside as the legal pad was. Another man might have asked her why she had felt compelled to not only bring along her work laptop on what was supposed to be a completely carefree vacation, but also to actually work. Reese DeMarco was not another man. So all he said was,
"You keep notes of all the cases the unit works?"
"Nothing classified or even confidential," she assured him. "Just brief notes I make for myself. Started it with the first case I worked. Then later on backtracked to study earlier cases and noted those too. And all the ones since, of course. Locations, who was on the team, the bare outlines of crimes, victims, monsters, and whether we caught or destroyed them. And how, if I thought it mattered." He nodded.
"Okay, and?"
"Well, I know we seldom do geographic profiles of the cases we work in these areas, mostly because it would be fairly useless in such small towns. And I don't think we've ever done a geographic profile of the whole southeast."
"Probably not," he agreed.
"I didn't really know what I was looking for when I got started," she confessed with a slight frown. "Something was bugging me, and I couldn't ignore it. So I just kept marking the places where we'd had cases. All those little towns, the few times all the action took place outside little towns, like the church, and that really weird case that wasn't, with Luther and Callie's location up in the mountains, and us at Alexander House." DeMarco nodded. "I marked everything I could find in my case notes, plus a couple of investigations I knew about, but in which the SCU was never officially involved, because the unit didn't officially exist at the time. Bishop was there, and he got involved. Like that town in North Carolina where his cousin Cassie helped catch a nasty killer, and even Atlanta, where Bishop helped his college friend look for his missing fiancée."
"News to me," DeMarco observed. "One of these days you'll have to tell me those stories."
"As much as I know, sure. I only found out because I'm nosy and kept asking questions." He smiled slightly, His normally rather coldly handsome face both relaxed and softened in a way that would have startled nearly everyone who knew him, but said only,
"So you marked all those places in the southeast where paranormal things involving various SCU agents and Haven operatives happened. And?"
She frowned at the map. "There are probably a dozen different ways to do this, but this is the one I picked." She reached for a sheet of clear plastic he hadn't noticed underneath the coffee table, on which were drawn several straight lines in red.
"Where on earth did you find that? Not in the chopper."
"No." Hollis looked a little guilty. "I took it out of the frame of that print over there." She nodded toward a suitably tropical print hanging on the wall between two narrow bookcases on the other side of the living room. "I wouldn't have if it were glass, but anyway, we might want to slip Mrs. Claremont a little bonus so she can replace this sheet of plastic."
"I doubt she'll even notice," DeMarco said.
"Yeah, but we know I took it," Hollis said absently as she slid the plastic over the map and placed it carefully. He smiled again, but waited until she had the plastic in place, and then leaned forward again to study the result for several moments.
"Huh.
Like I said, probably a dozen different ways to draw lines from one place to another and make some sort of pattern. But this is the one that felt right to me." She had drawn, in essence, an asterisk, or perhaps more accurately, a kind of sunburst, with straight lines of differing lengths beginning at a marked location on the outer edge of the large cluster and ending at the opposite outer edge, both the starting point and the end point of each line a location of paranormal events, with several others along the line itself. Every single case she had noted fell along one of the precisely straight lines she had drawn. "Look at what's at the center," she said steadily.
DeMarco looked. "Damn. Prosperity."
"Yeah, prosperity. It looks like it's been at the center of some very bad things for a long time. The very quiet, very peaceful center. Until now." After a moment, DeMarco said,
"By the time we finish packing and loading the chopper, the sun should be up and Mrs. Claremont as well, so we can turn in the keys. I think we should head for the mountain house ASAP."
"I think you're right," Hollis said. 5. Wednesday, October 8. Sheriff Jackson Archer studied what appeared to be the scene of a suicide, holding on to professional detachment as best he could. He was a good cop and a popular sheriff, and though he had spent a few years with the Charlotte police in order to acquire the sort of experience a small, ordinarily peaceful mountain town rarely offered, and even more rarely needed, the truth was that prosperity had been exceptionally peaceful since he'd taken office, and he suspected he'd gotten used to that. So professional detachment was difficult. Not that any cop could, with complete detachment, view a scene in which a man had blown most of his head off.
"Why a shotgun?"
his chief deputy Katie Cole asked, her own detachment having long since departed. Her voice shook more than a little, and her face was paper white. That shock looked odd on her, unfamiliar, at least to Archer, because he'd really never seen her anything but calm, professional, and both courteous and pleasant enough to hide the steel inside her from all but those who knew her well. He had taken some flack for hiring an outsider to be his chief deputy, rather than promoting from within, but Katie had a background in law enforcement, and both her friendly, easy manner and her solid training, sharpshooter proficiency on the shooting range, and skilled physical workouts in the gym that had pushed other, larger deputies to their limits, had mostly quieted the early rumblings in his department. Plus, experience in working with her day to day had convinced even the most jealous of her hiring and rank that she was indeed the best qualified for the job of chief deputy. Though those same people might have been forgiven for revising their impressions now. Because right now, her pale face caused her dark blonde hair, worn in a casual ponytail that made her look far younger than 32, appear even darker, and her normally sharp hazel eyes were dark and disturbed. She looked a little shocked, a little frightened, and more than a little unsure of what to do next. He didn't blame her for that, any of that.
"Why a shotgun?"
she repeated when the silence had lengthened.
"Beats the hell out of me,"
Archer responded grimly. From her position several feet farther from the body than the sheriff's, Katie said with a stab at professionalism, if not detachment,
"I can see with those long arms of his, he could easily reach the trigger even with the end of the barrel up under his chin like that. And it's obvious he did from his position. But why use a shotgun when he owns several other guns?"
"Guess he wanted to make sure he got the job done."
Katie eyed her superior, in part because it was a far less stomach-churning view than that of the victim. He was 38, tall, rugged in a way that made him look more like the sheriff of an old west town than a 21st-century small mountain town. She had caught herself more than once expecting to hear the metallic jingling of spurs. He had dark brown hair with a bit of silver mixed in, level gray eyes, and an almost always calm voice that could turn persuasive or hard as nails, depending on what the situation called for. He had one broken marriage behind him, a not uncommon curse of law enforcement work, but he didn't talk about that and Katie hadn't asked. He was a good cop, a good boss, and a man the people of Prosperity and the sprinkling of other smaller towns in Fox County respected a great deal. The sort of man people would turn to in a crisis. Katie just hoped that would be the case now, that the citizens of Prosperity would see in him a steadying hand, even when things got bad, very bad, as she knew they would during what she could feel was coming, what had already started. And she very much hoped Jackson Archer could at least accept the existence of something he would quite probably never understand. Otherwise, what was going to destroy so much would destroy him as well. Dragging her thoughts back to the here and now, she said,
"He chose to blow most of his head off on an otherwise normal Wednesday morning, with his wife upstairs fixing breakfast, and the kids still getting ready for school?"
She shook her head.
"I know he keeps all his guns down here in that gun safe, but would a father of three blow his brains out in the basement with his kids in the house?"
Archer drew a breath and let it out in a rough sigh, not impatient with his deputy, but clearly baffled himself.
"It seems clear he did, since he kept his other arm across the gun. It barely moved when he let go with both barrels. His fingers still stuck in the trigger guard, and it's the right finger on the right hand, that is to say, the correct hand, his left. He was a southpaw."
The victim of what appeared to be a suicide, Sam Bowers, 33, was seated on an old couch in the basement that was the only real piece of furniture in a space filled with plastic storage bins, on homemade wooden shelving, and one fairly large, obviously homemade table beside the washer and dryer, presumably used for folding clothing when it came out of the dryer. The couch had been pushed up against one of the cinder block walls, and the area behind what had been Bauer's head was now splashed with blood and bits of skull and brain matter. A lot of blood and a lot of brain matter. It was a gruesome sight. It was the sight Stacy Bowers had found when she had come halfway down the basement steps to see what she'd expected to be a repentant husband, one of whose guns had unaccountably gone off at 7 in the morning. One of those people who handled emergencies with calm and then fell apart afterward, she had managed not to scream, hurried back up the stairs and closed and locked the basement door, called a neighbor to take the kids so they'd be out of the house, and then after hustling them on their way, called 911. She had still been calm enough when the sheriff and his deputies arrived to tell them where the body of her husband was and why he had gone downstairs. Or at least, why she'd believed he'd gone downstairs. White as a sheet, and with a steady voice that had finally begun to break by the time she finished telling them what she had to. After that, she had fallen apart, literally dropping to the floor with an agonized moan, and was now upstairs in the living room still sobbing, her shock and grief deep and genuine, with a sympathetic but otherwise helpless female deputy with her and the family doctor on his way. Her thoughts clearly running along the same lines, Katie said,
"Stacy won't be able to tell us anything, assuming she even can, for a while. I'm betting her family doctor will want to sedate her."
"Yeah, probably. Did you call her sister?"
Katie nodded. "Should be here in about half an hour. She was already at work, so coming from downtown out here. She said she'd take Stacy and the kids to her house, that they'd stay with her as long as they needed to."
"How did she react to Sam's death?"
Archer knew Heather Davidson, who worked at the courthouse, and he knew she was neither easily shaken nor a fool. And the sisters were close.
"Shocked. Genuinely shocked. Said there was no way it was suicide and sounded absolutely positive about it."
Archer's frown deepened.
"No note. Not down here, not in their bedroom, not in his briefcase. He's dressed for work at the bank as usual. According to his wife, he just came down here while she was busy with breakfast to get a few things out of that chest freezer over there and carry them upstairs for tonight's supper. Just a routine morning, a common chore.
Until it had turned into something horrible." Jim Lonigan examined the shotgun carefully, then the revolver, handling both with expert hands. Then the rifle, which looked a lot like the two his father had left him. All his attention was focused on what he was doing, but he became vaguely aware that the gun store's owner, John Robbins, was speaking briskly.
"No problem with the background check, of course, but there wouldn't be, you being a cop and all. But I thought you didn't approve of guns in the house, Jim. I mean, I know your service weapon has to be there, but in a gun safe when you're off duty so any kids in the house can't get to it."
Calmly, Lonigan said,
"Don't worry. They'll be under lock and key as well. I've ordered a nice display case for the man cave half of the basement."
He laughed a little. Robbins laughed as well.
"She'll let you have half, then? Well, at least you aren't out in the garage. That's the only man cave my wife lets me have."
Lonigan smiled at him.
"I've fixed it up nice. Big couch, TV, pool table. I'll store my golf clubs down there. And these guns. The cabinet has a good lock. I made sure of that." "I imagine you did."
Robbins finished ringing up the sale, adding in the boxes of ammo Lonigan had requested, and a thick pack of paper targets that could be pinned up on hay bales or stuffed dummies, or just at the firing range in the basement of the sheriff's department. Robbins assumed one or more of those places would suit Jim Lonigan.
"There you go."
He handed over change and watched Lonigan stuff it into the front pocket of his jeans carelessly before zipping the shotgun and rifle into a single carrying case and the revolver into its holster. The ammo was bagged up for him, and he picked up everything before reaching over to shake Robbins's hand.
"Thanks, John. See you around."
"You too, Jim."
He watched the other man leave, and it wasn't until then that he realized he was wiping his hand down his jean-clad thigh over and over unconsciously. He frowned, then shrugged. Everybody has cold, clammy hands sometimes. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing at all.
"A considerate husband,"
Katie said rather mournfully about the late Sam Bowers.
"He brought that basket of dirty clothes down for her, too."
The basket, heaped with clothing, sat on top of the dryer some feet from the couch and victim. Archer grunted.
We'll know more when we talk to his co-workers at the bank and check into the family's finances. But I never heard they were having troubles financially.
No, me either. Never heard there were any marital problems.
We'll have to talk to friends and family, Archer said. Outsiders usually don't know what goes on inside a marriage. Not all of it, at least. But they may have noticed something.
Something worth Sam killing himself over? Katie shook her head. I don't see that.
Neither do I, but neither one of us was him. Some people handle problems easily and some don't. It could have gotten to be too much for him. Something could have.
The sheriff paused, adding,
But I'd expect a note. Most people who commit suicide feel the need to explain why, especially when they have family bound to be shocked, and when everything looks good from the outside, so there's no obvious reason for suicide.
Yeah. When I went next door to talk to the neighbor who's keeping the kids, she was completely stunned, doing her best to keep the kids busy and distracted from what's happened and happening over here, of course. Two of them are too young to understand or have any idea what's happened, and the oldest is only 8, so he's just mostly scared and worried. Where was I going with this?
The neighbor was stunned. It's Hannah Seaton, right?
Yeah. First time I'd met her. Anyway, she was completely stunned. Said Sam Bowers would never in a million years commit suicide. Said he was devoted to Stacy, adored his kids, and never missed a chance to have family time. Both families often barbecued, she said. Their kids playing together, and she's absolutely certain there was nothing wrong with that marriage or their life. Said they were two of the happiest people she'd ever known.
Archer looked at her, baffled.
Well, family and neighbors don't always see, but unless we find something sticking out in their financial records or phone records, or something bad happening with his job, I'm having a hard time seeing this as a suicide myself, in spite of how it looks. Also having a hard time seeing it as anything else. I'll hand over my pension if his wife had anything to do with it.
Katie wasn't as startled as she wished she could be.
I know if there's any question about a death, we have to look at the spouse always, but this looks like a suicide right enough. And if it wasn't one, all my questions still stand, plus quite a few more. Why here in the basement with the kids upstairs? On an otherwise normal Wednesday morning? Why no note? And if it wasn't suicide, if somebody killed him, who could have managed that here? I don't believe Stacy could have done it any more than you do. For one thing, she didn't have a drop of blood on her minutes after this happened, according to Hannah Seaton. And I'm willing to bet the doc will say if anybody but Sam Bowers pulled that trigger, they'd have had plenty of blowback all over them.
She tried not to sound as queasy as she was when she added,
You can see some of the spray on his pants and even on the floor close to the couch.
Yeah, I know. But if it wasn't suicide, if it was somebody else killed him, somebody who didn't belong in the house today, then how'd they get in? This isn't a walk-out basement, and there's no egress at all. So anybody coming into the house would have had to come from upstairs. Actually, through the kitchen to get to the basement door.
Katie nodded. They have a decent security system, which Stacy said was always on at night, turned off only when she and Sam came downstairs in the morning. No signs any of the doors or windows had been forced. According to Stacy, she was in the kitchen from the time they came downstairs.
It was Archer's turn to nod slowly.
And even supposing a killer managed to get in at some point when the system was off, might have lain in wait down here for God knows how long, with God knows what motive driving him, how was he able to get Sam to just peacefully sit down and let his head get blown off with his own shotgun?
No signs of a struggle, Katie offered. I suppose he could have been hit on the head before he had any sense of a threat. The shotgun blast would have removed all signs of a blitz attack.
Archer nodded again, but said, "Say that's what happened. Say somebody hid down here as long as it took, knew the combination of the gun safe, which also requires the fingerprint of Sam Bowers to gain access, though if he was knocked out, that wouldn't have been more than a slightly awkward problem. Where was I going?"
It was a characteristic both the sheriff and the chief deputy shared, though Katie wasn't at all sure whether one of them had caught it from the other.
"Say somebody did hide down here," she prompted.
"Yeah, say somebody did and then managed to surprise Sam and knocked him out without making enough noise to alert Stacy. Then he positioned Sam with his own shotgun, stage-managed it to look like suicide, and pulled the trigger himself. Setting aside the question of blowback, since for all we know he could have been wearing a fucking hazmat suit, how the hell did he get out? Stacy not only closed the basement door until we got here, she locked it. She was sitting at the kitchen table waiting for us, staring at the locked door. And I've had a deputy stationed at the door upstairs since we got here."
"It doesn't seem possible, much less likely.
Even if Sam Bowers had done anything to make an enemy that bad, and from everything we've heard so far, everybody liked him."
"I've never heard a bad word spoken of him," Archer agreed, then frowned at her. "Why are you rubbing the back of your neck?"
Katie realized only then what she'd been doing, and forced her hand to drop. The nape of her neck was still tingling, and it felt to her like a warning. A less definite warning than the first one had been, but a warning all the same. She wanted to reach out with her mind, to probe, but that first warning had been all too definite. She had to protect her mind with every shield, every barrier she had learned to build around it. She was vulnerable in ways most others weren't. Vulnerable the way those she expected to come help would be vulnerable. "Awful to be so sure this is bad in ways we don't understand yet, and worse is coming. And I still don't know how to tell him. Hell, what to tell him? How can I?"
All she said in response to the sheriff's question was,
"I'm feeling tense, I guess. I've never seen anything like this before, Jack."
He appeared to accept that. "No, me either. Not even in Charlotte." He paused. "Where the hell is Doc Forrest?"
He was not the Bowers family doctor, but the one Archer had chosen to call out for this because he had worked in an ME's office in another state and knew his way around bodies in ways the average doctor in Prosperity didn't. Prosperity didn't have an official medical examiner or coroner, because they'd never needed one, and because Archer could always draw on the state network of specially trained doctors qualified to serve as medical examiners.
"He's on his way," Katie reported. "Said from the way I had described it, we'd probably have to call in a proper ME, but he couldn't be sure until he sees what's here."
"You told him we're having doubts about it being a suicide," the sheriff said, not accusingly.
"Well, he asked. And I said it looked like it, but didn't really make sense to us. But didn't make sense as an accident or a murder, either. He said if it isn't suicide and he can't find anything to satisfy us that it was, or even that it wasn't, that it could have been an accident or even murder, we'd need to call in an ME because as good as he is, as good as the equipment in the hospital is, we may need somebody more used to looking at crime scenes than he is. Said in his work at that medical examiner's office, he was the one who stayed behind and assisted in autopsies and lab work, not the one who went out in the field."
"He might have told me that sooner," Archer said with a sigh.
"Yeah, that's what I told him. He said there hadn't been any reason to until today."
Archer shifted restlessly, his gaze still fixed on the body.
"I don't want to call in an ME from the state network unless I have to. But if I have to, I will. I just sure as hell don't want to declare this a crime scene without anything but my own gut to back me up."
Katie nodded in agreement, but said,
One good thing, if I can call it that, is that if this is a crime scene, it's pretty contained. I believe Stacy didn't come more than halfway down the stairs, and since then it's just been you and me here. I mean, we can lock the basement door and seal it, post a deputy, and nobody we don't okay is coming down here.
Yeah. Look, I don't know if the doc will bring a camera with him, but we need pictures of this whole space, and before anybody disturbs anything. Use your cell phone and I'll use mine, just to be on the safe side.
His department didn't have an official photographer either, something Archer made a mental note to change. ASAP. Copy. Katie was just glad to have something to do, especially when the sheriff began taking pictures of the body in that area of the basement, and she could turn to look elsewhere in the very ordinary basement where something not ordinary had happened. She did her best to ignore the crawly tingle on the nape of her neck. The sheriff would have to know, of course, sooner or later. But right now, Katie still wasn't at all willing to try to explain something she couldn't prove and couldn't even really define, especially to a man as practical and rational as Jackson Archer. They had never discussed the paranormal, but she was fairly certain his first reaction wouldn't be one of acceptance. Not at least until he was faced with something even his practical and rational mind could accept as much further beyond normal than even an inexplicable suicide. Katie was just afraid of what that might be. The Gathering. Walking with a friend in the dark is better than walking alone in the light. Helen Keller. Life is short, and we have never too much time for gladdening the hearts of those who are traveling the dark journey with us. Oh, be swift to love. Make haste to be kind. Henri Frédéric Amiel. 6. Wednesday, October 8. The study of the Mountain House was in reality a highly functional command center, its true purpose only betrayed at first glance by the massive conference table in the center of the room, which could seat a dozen people in comfortable office chairs without crowding, and more if need be. At second glance, it was clear that various high-tech toys were cunningly integrated among bookshelves and gleaming cabinetry that lined two walls, and at least three workstations were tucked into comfortable niches spaced apart, each with spectacular views of the Blue Ridge Mountains. Completing the huge room and effectively removing any lingering sense of being in a place designed only for work were several comfortable seating areas scattered about invitingly, including a large grouping of two long couches and a couple of wide, deep chairs in front of a rock fireplace, where gas logs burned cheerfully and warded off the deepening chill of an October afternoon. Olivia Castle was one of half a dozen people sitting there, maybe avoiding the conference table and the tablets and paper files and legal pads already assembled during the day, because she wasn't quite ready to truly confront the seriousness and the scary uncertainty of what they were going to face, but more probably because she still felt chilled and welcomed the warmth of the fire. Rex, curled up in her lap after spending the entire morning exploring and happily meeting new friends as well as greeting old ones, was certainly enjoying it. Especially since he was out of the hated carrier, and because there was a cook in residence who understood the delicate palate of discerning cats. Hollis Templeton and her partner, Rhys DeMarco, had arrived earlier than expected late in the morning, bearing a map and at least the beginnings of an unsettling theory of why they had all been summoned. Or at least, why Prosperity. Right now, they were silent, faces thoughtful, possibly considering various introductions made in the last hour or so, just as Olivia was. They shared one of the big overstuffed chairs, with Hollis sitting in it and DeMarco sitting on one of its wide arms. The partners never seemed to get very far away from each other, Olivia noted. Not that they were clingy or anything like that, just
Connected. Obviously connected. Hollis was a slender, almost delicate woman of medium height, with short, no-fuss brown hair and eyes of an unusual shade of blue, very bright and aware in her lightly tanned face. Her other features were good without being in any way remarkable, but that changed the instant she smiled, and animation transformed the ordinary into something more than beautiful could ever be. DeMarco might have been less well-known among the non-SCU community of psychics than his partner, but that was because his FBI career for some years before he met Hollis had consisted of a number of highly secretive, deep-cover assignments. Since leaving that more stealthy life behind, he was definitely becoming better known. Physically, he was rather overpowering on many levels. He was very large, and clearly possessed the kind of strength that could never be earned in a gym, but what any woman would notice immediately was his thick blonde hair, extremely sharp blue eyes, and perfect classical handsomeness. It was as if his still, watchful face had been carved from stone by a master sculptor. Olivia had felt just a little frightened of him initially, which tended to be her default response to large, unfamiliar men. But the first time she'd seen him lean down to say something quietly to his partner, his stone face softened and made very human if only for that fleeting moment. Her fear had left her. Galen, another large and powerful man who also made her feel wary, had not made an appearance in the last hour or so. Olivia could remember hearing him say something to Bishop about weapons, and she assumed, without wanting to spend any time at all thinking about it, he was off gathering whatever it had been decided the team would need. Both Bishop and Miranda were also absent from the room for the moment, called away quietly by a dark man they hadn't introduced for some reason he hadn't explained. Olivia was more than a little worried about that, but she did her best not to think about it until she had to. She considered it a cowardly trait, doing that, but it was the way she had dealt with scary things her whole life, and she doubted very much that would change any time soon. Instead of thinking about scary possibilities, she allowed her gaze to wander from person to person, their scattered positions around the room not, she hoped uneasily, a sign of a team that didn't know how to be one. Tori, Victoria Stark, stood alone near one of the big windows, not taking advantage of what looked like a long, comfortable window seat as she gazed out at the view without, it was obvious from her preoccupied expression, taking much, if any, notice of it. She was younger than Olivia, but seemed older, with all the calm, self-control, and shrewd watchfulness Olivia felt she herself lacked. She was of medium height, on the thin side, but much, much stronger than she looked, and possessed silvery blonde hair cut short and expressive green eyes. Sharing Olivia's couch was Reno, serene as always. She didn't look as if she'd pretty much crossed the country twice in a jet in less than 24 hours and with no more than brief stops, neither the least bit rumpled nor seemingly in need of sleep. Nor did she appear at all disturbed that one of the three men who had been aboard that jet when it had landed at the airstrip earlier had been sending her hard glares since they had arrived here. And probably, Olivia thought, all the way from Alaska. Not quite ready to brave those glares, even if they weren't directed specifically at her, Olivia looked across at the other couch, which was occupied by the two other men who had arrived with Reno, the wide space between them more indicative of an automatic reluctance to get too physically close to anyone because of their abilities than of any personal animosity. Sully Maitland she knew well. Born an empath and a strong one, he was still, at 32, working to strengthen his shields. It was one of the reasons he chose to live on a fairly isolated horse ranch in Montana. He was 6'2" and powerful, dark hair graying at the temples, a sign of struggle more than years, and the most intense golden eyes Olivia had ever seen in a human face.
She had seen something very like them once before, but those intense golden eyes had belonged to a tiger, and not one caged in a zoo. Like Olivia, Sully was cursed with headaches and blackouts, and like her, he considered the blackouts something of a blessing, as long as they happened in private rather than public, and